Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an overview of the economic challenges ahead facing the new Secretary of the Treasury and the extent to which he understands them. Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, joins us to discuss whether Jack Lew recognizes the systemic risk posed by the big banks and whether they are sufficiently regulated to prevent another meltdown, which the Treasury will not have the funds to bail out next time. Then, with President Obama having just met in the Oval Office with Afghanistan's kleptocrat-in-chief, Karzai, we'll be joined by Robert Young Pelton, an author, filmmaker, journalist, and explorer who has spent 5 weeks on missions in the mountains of Afghanistan with the U.S. Special Forces hunting the Taliban. We will discuss what is happening on the ground as Karzai asks for more American money for his family and cronies. Then finally, with yesterday the third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti, which took 300,000 lives and left over a million others homeless, we'll be joined in studio by Amy Wilentz, the author of a new book, Farewell Fred Voodoo, A Letter from Haiti. She has an article in, also has an article in today's Los Angeles Times. For journalists today, the whole world is watching. And joining us now is Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow at the Director of the Global Finance Project at the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanships of Joseph Stiglitz. And previously, Robert Johnson was a Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the Budget Committee. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Johnson.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
And do you accept the premise in my introduction, Rob, that the question is, does Jack Lew, since he's a budget expert, does he understand finance, does he understand Wall Street, and does he understand the systemic risk posed by the banks that are now even too big to fail? And if there is a another meltdown, and apparently there's no early warning system in place, the Treasury next time simply won't have the funds to bail out Wall Street.
Well, I would say the criticisms that Jack Lew is not an expert in, which you might call the architecture of the financial system, are quite valid. On the same time, someone who's worked in that realm, but very intensely over time, someone like Tim Geithner, who is part of the Robert Rubin sensibility, may have a great deal of expertise, but he essentially governed of, by, and for the banks, not for the people, not for a system that, in the medium term has the stability and avoids the too-big-to-fail problems and the systemic propagation that we all fear right now. So I don't know if Jake Lew should be criticized in the sense that he could get a constellation of undersecretaries and deputies, but the real question is he, as another member of the Rubin fold, is likely to adopt the same perspective. And as Bob Kuttner once said, we do not have a team of rivals, we have a team of Rubins across the spectrum in Obama's economic policy. And this man who talked about vote for hope and change is really just doing reruns on the Clinton administration.
So how can you explain that, though, Rob Johnson, given that Wall Street gave most of their money to Romney and Obama got money from Main Street, from average Americans, and, of course, in 2008, he got the lion's share of Wall Street's money, no doubt about it. What does he owe Wall Street? Why isn't he pivoting back to Main Street, where he really owes a debt to, and why is he indulging Wall Street, who did everything they could to prevent his re-election?
Well, my sense is that Obama, first of all, is not a particularly sophisticated financial and economic thinker. He's much better on issues like constitutional law and what have you. So, being a little bit fish out of water, he's afraid, in my sense, of what you might call aggravating the confidence of Wall Street. It's almost as if the entire society and system now is hostage to these large, concentrated financial institutions who can do so much harm. And Obama may be very well-meaning in his desire to, what you might call, facilitate the recovery and create confidence and fortify the well-being of America. But you can't do that without the financial sector in the current structure. So I think he's between a rock and a hard place, because a proper financial system, properly structured, properly regulated, properly supervised, would take an awful lot of power out of the hands of the sector that has been absolutely the most powerful sector in America for the last 20 years.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, the Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. So, what then, in terms of forming a countervailing alliance against the power of Wall Street? Surely there are economic interests in the United States that recognize the continuing financialization of our economy means that it's unsustainable over the long term, because Wall Street's only mostly about extracting wealth, not creating wealth. And the traditional American industries, and I suppose an example out here in California are the Silicon Valley people. They're about innovation and creating products, not making paper profits. Can you organize a countervailing economic force to curtail the domination of our economy by Wall Street?
Well, I think, as you say, it's imperative that we do create an economic and political structure which is oriented towards a broader sharing of the proceeds. When you bring up Silicon Valley, the only thing I take issue with is an awful lot of their technological innovation has been associated with displacement of labor and increasingly skilled labor. And a lot of the Silicon Valley firms have been very, very aggressive in this last year or two, doing stock buybacks and other things, not investing in R&D, and shedding pensions and shedding high-level wage employees in favor of younger people who are overseas who work for less than half the price.
So they've got the disease as well. it's systemic and endemic, right, in American capitalism.
And the other factor is top managements are paying themselves with stock options and fantastic creations of financial engineering. So even a non-financial corporation that may be what you might call the base of a broad prosperity and sharing works in partnership with investment bankers and with Wall Street and engineers the compensation structures of that company to benefit investors in the stock market and benefit top management, often to the detriment of the rest of the company.
So, Rob Johnson, an example of that, of course, is in Sunday's New York Times, an article called Our Economic Pickle by Stephen Greenhouse that points out that Caterpillar, long a symbol of American industry, while it reported record profits last year, it insisted on a 6-year wage freeze for many of its blue-collar workers, and wages have fallen to a record low as a share of America's gross domestic product. Last year's wages fell to a record low of 43.5%, and since 2001, when the wage share was 49%. So there's pretty stark evidence that capital has been the beneficiary of increased productivity, but American capitalists are not sharing the bounty with their workers.
That's right, and I think the presence of increased global competition from very, very intense, particularly Asian, Indian, and Chinese workforce, is driving down the returns to wages and driving up the returns to capital, just as someone like Paul Samuelson predicted would happen in the early 1970s. At the time he received the Nobel Prize, he wrote an article for the Swedish Chamber of Commerce called International Trade for a Rich Country, which was all about how, with the dynamism of technical change and large pools of unskilled labor in developing countries, we were going to have some tough sledding for 30 or 40 years in the United States. And if anything, he underestimated the depth and duration of this challenge.
Well, is that to say then, Rob Johnson, that globalism has become an excuse for American capitalists to be greedy?
What's clear, when you look at comparative statistics, Germany, the Scandinavians, some Latin American countries, that none of this is inevitable. These are policy choices. In Germany, the distribution of wealth and income has not been widening particularly. Lots of people in the blue-collar and lower-level world. I'm sitting in Detroit, Michigan today, and the devastation of the auto industry in Detroit is not matched by a similar devastation of the auto industry in Germany, and both countries faced the same global economy. So some of this is technology. Some of this has to do with globalization, but a lot of it has to do with the policy choices and the definition and the vision of what constitutes a society. Regulation, role of labor unions, the tax code are all parts of this architecture. And in the United States, what you call the capitalist class have gotten away with their designs, much to the detriment of a very large proportion of the population.
So my understanding, though, in Germany, and it's kind of an irony that the Marshall Plan that we rescued the German and European economies and Japan's economy and gave them these economic structures, including full health care and all of the things that we don't have over here. But one of the things that they have in Germany, my understanding, is that the companies that you just mentioned, the German auto industry, on the boards of directors of BMW and Mercedes and other German car companies, 50% of the seats on the boards of directors are given over to union representation.
I think they do a much better job of representing all the stakeholders and the creation of value added in the German auto industry than they do really in any sector in the United States. Probably the only sector in the United States, and this is a laughable irony, that is thoroughly represented as a workforce is the Wall Street workforce and the amount of bonus pool that they take out of those publicly listed companies. The stocks of places like Morgan Stanley, Citibank, and others tolerate a huge compensation pool for their workforce, something that would not be tolerated in any other sector.
Again, I'm speaking with Robert Johnson, Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking, and he was formerly Managing Director of Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist for the United States Senate Banking Committee and the United States Senate Budget Committee. So what is the problem here then in terms of the public's understanding of the economy? Because you have these well-funded deficit hawks like the Wall Street billionaire Pete Peterson has been out spending a lot of his money to tell us the sky is falling and that the deficits are ruining us and that should be our priority, that all Americans, working Americans and middle-class Americans should tighten their belts, while people on Wall Street should be we should take the handcuffs off and unrestrain them and their wealth will trickle down. Now, contrast that with Jack Kennedy's famous line, a rising tide raises all boats. Why not at this moment where we're going to have another economic hostage crisis over the debt ceiling and the deficit hawks are going to go to the mat for the billionaires, even though that drives up the cost of debt as it did last time when we get downgraded because of their insane antics? Why not have a countervailing debate? Why doesn't the White House step up here and say, wait a minute, these people are insane, but this is what we really need to bring our economy back?
I believe, going back to the start of your question, what the public is not acknowledging, at one level they understand this, but they are not acknowledging the powerful feedback loops that exist between wealth and the manipulation of the rules of the game. A capitalist democracy receives its legitimacy from being democratically governed. But when you can buy and sell the rules of the game, the powerful can reset the rules over and over again to their benefit and the public's detriment. Pete Peterson may be correct in a sensible sense that there is a budget crisis, but the budget crisis does not come from all the little people of America over-consuming. It comes from concentrated interests who who are holding fundraisers for those same self-righteous congressmen and senators talking about a budget crisis, so that we have health care costs that are more than double what any other country has, while being only rated 37th in the world in the quality of the care that we provide. And you have concentrated interests, particularly in the pharmaceutical industry and the insurance industry. And then you have all these kind of ridiculous compensating things where doctors are forced to go through all kinds of hoops when they're not making extraordinary incomes in comparison with the biotechnology of pharmaceuticals and insurance companies. So I believe we actually have to return medicine to the care of doctors and take it out of the hands of businessmen. The businessmen are backing people up like they're pushing you against the wall because of the vulnerabilities of your health. Biggest cause of bankruptcy in America and the biggest cause of deficit concerns in America are our dysfunctional health system. But the broader point that applies to finance, military-industrial complex, and everything else is that we will not fix our budget problems until we fix our governance problems and get money out of politics.
Well, you would think that a political argument could be offered that, for example, it's the Republicans who are essentially the welfare queens. Look at what happened under the Republican Congress when they forbid the U.S. government in Medicare from collective bargaining and bulk buying of pharmaceuticals to drive down the cost. And one of the reasons why we have out of control medical costs is that the drug pharmaceutical monopolies basically can write their own ticket because the government is prevented by the Republican Congress from from competitive bidding. And
the only place, Ian, where I would differ with your comment is this is not a Republican problem or a Democrat problem. This is a bipartisan problem that is a structural problem in the competition for campaign contributions and the competition for contributions, because we no longer have a system in the House or the Senate where leadership positions are the basis of seniority and longevity in office. They're the basis of who raises the most money, who puts the most on the table. The people who are the most corrupt in selling policy, and I use the term corrupt because it's legal, but it is legal corruption, those are the people who assume power, and the system is designed to generate corporate welfare, what economists call rent-seeking, and it is not a Republican problem or a Democratic problem, though you may be perhaps right that the Republicans' anti-government diatribes are the most disingenuous because they are also at the center of this fundraising competition.
Well, Rob, I don't want to leave in despair. What's your final prescription here?
I'm reading a book right now by James Cone, theologian at Union Theological Seminary. It's called The Cross and the Lynching Tree. And the parable of our current, or the analogy or the metaphor of our current time, is that when things get bad, such as the lynching and the racism, it sets in motion a redemptive energy, a coiling spring, and a power. And the population, if they care for the values of this 200-and-some-year experiment called the United States of America, the population has to now start engaging, become active, not only in scrutinizing and studying, but they have to start voting people out of office and demanding changes in the rules and even constitutional amendments. We need broad-based, active, collective action. Despondency will not do. And as Dr. Cone talks about in The Cross and the Lynching Tree, after a certain point, you know that your only path is to take action and to resist these evils. And I think we're getting closer to that time right now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Robert Johnson.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Robert Johnson, who's Executive Director of the Institute for New Economic Thinking and a Senior Fellow and Director of the Global Finance Project for the Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt Institute. He recently served on the United Nations Commission of Experts on International Monetary Reform under the chairmanship of Joseph Stiglitz, and previously was Managing Director at Soros Fund Management and was Chief Economist of the United States Senate Banking Committee and of the United States Senate Budget Committee. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to Robert Young Pelton, who just spent the last 5 weeks in the mountains of Afghanistan with the U.S. Special Forces hunting down the Taliban.